again I say rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord always, again I say rejoice. Rejoice, rejoice, again I say rejoice. Rejoice, rejoice, again I say rejoice.
One more time.
Rejoice in the Lord always, again I say rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord always, again I say rejoice. Rejoice, rejoice, again I say rejoice.
I'd like to spend the time this morning maybe sharing a little bit of your own reflections, and if you were able to do some of the homework assignment, kind of what you discovered about yourself, any questions that you have about that. And then the second part of this morning's sessions, I want to talk about children and children's group in terms of family loss, separation, dysfunction. Are people able to do some of their homework assignments? Mm-hmm. What did you discover about yourself?
I'm mainly sad and scared.
Mainly sad and scared?
Yes.
Okay.
I do a lot of bargaining.
Do a lot of bargaining, so a lot of...
Mm-hmm.
What was the feeling you saw attached to that? You able to put a tip?
Fear that if I'm really myself, the other person will reject me, and I'll lose that other person. So it's like, I want to keep things in balance.
So fear of abandonment or fear of rejection? Exactly. Other people?
I found that I had a lot of mad ones on my right hand column, more than I thought.
So a lot of mad, a lot of anger.
Depression for me.
Depression. What about others? What did you discover?
I think that the business of some depression, being, you know, sense of scared coming into a new situation here, but also the sense of too that there's a healing and acceptance and transformation process also going on to it, I believe. But I still need to work on it.
I found that anger really covered up scare for me.
Anger covered up.
Covers up hurt for me too.
Scared and hurt. See, and as I listen, part of what I discover, see, when we are able to get down to this level of understanding our scared and our sad and our anger and our depression. See, when you hear it at that human level, what feeling does it generate inside toward people when you hear them saying those things?
Compassion.
Release too.
Pardon?
A kind of a sense of release.
A release, a kind of relief that begins to come out. Yeah.
Understanding.
I'm not the only one.
I'm not the only one, so there's kind of a, I belong, I'm not alone. See, this is the commonality of who we are as human beings. And we get frozen in grief and we suffer and split and you know, hurt and violate and judge and condemn because we tend to always get preoccupied with the external behavior. Those coping or those survival mechanisms that we get immobilized and frozen in together. When we are able to transform that and get to the level where we share in common our scares, our sadness, our hurt, our pain, our anger. See, at that level, see, then it, you know, I mean, it really kind of dissipates out. When a person is able to identify and acknowledge what's really there, underneath, that's where the hope for acceptance and transformation and forgiveness comes. There's a lot of acceptance when I can hear somebody in their vulnerability and their pain. If I'm just exposed to their reactive behaviors, their compulsiveness, their depression, their agitation, their critical anger or their externalized anger, then the response is usually one of distancing, of separation, of loss. See, and that's where a lot of the loss and grief is that many times we become stuck. We become stuck in those coping or protective behaviors, and they're there for a purpose because what they do is they protect us. They're ways we try to insulate, they're ways we try to isolate, they're ways that we try to withdraw and protect ourselves. But there are very severe consequences, and the consequences are alienation, loss, pain, kind of lack of understanding, and the very thing we're afraid of, the fear of abandonment and rejection, is the very consequence we experience when we get stuck in the grief process. So. And that's the self-fulfilling prophecy. That it's easy to get mired and stuck in grief. And even though we do all these things to protect ourselves, to assume and think that we can make it through, in fact, the very thing we are most terrified about is the reality that we perpetuate by our own frozen grief. And I want you to hear that clearly because the importance of that is the recognition and understanding is that we are the only ones empowered to release ourselves from the grief, from the terror, from the fear, from the scare. And that's the miracle of Christ. The miracle of Christ is not a sense of taking things on and holding things in and putting out an image and becoming awesome and powerful. The miracle of Christ is giving up, is letting go, is sinking deeply, allowing myself that full expression of my brokenness. Get my blood poured out for you. So it's a full vulnerability and sensitivity. And that's scary, because you're in a world out here that tends to be cynical and critical and bitter and judgmental. It's frightening to be vulnerable. Yet when you can begin to experience, just as you are getting to share, a few people shared, they're scared and they're hurt and they're sad, and yet look at the compassion that suddenly comes out. And look at the transformation. And a lot of people say, well, transformation and healing, that's miraculous. See, and I don't think it's miraculous at all. I think it's very fundamental and basic to human life. You know, the sadness is that we are intimidated and frightened from what is our birthright. The sadness is when we get stuck in our grief, we can't know our joy and ecstasy. The good news is the more that we are able to experience one another in compassion as suffering with, and know that we are accepted and heard and valued in that, to the depth and to the level that I am able to acknowledge my suffering, I increase my capacity for celebration and joy. When you experience that relief and that release, there is such a lightness. You know, I talked yesterday about energy blocks. And when that block of energy is released, there is a physical transformation. You remember what it's like to come out of a depression? Or to suddenly let go or to feel forgiven? You feel 15, 20 pounds lighter. Suddenly there's just this sense of lightheadedness and you're able to sing and laugh and play and go out and do silly things. And when you look outside, you tend to see things brighter. The sky is clearer, the greens are greener, the air is fresher. See that there's a literal release that makes me receptive once again. my vulnerability and my capacity for life becomes a lot. And that's the issue. Now, the major thing that I want to share around that is in when you are in grief, see, it's easy to intellectually describe a process, but it's important to understand that the process is slow and unfolding. There are moments of deep catharsis where I go deep into my emotion and feel the intensity of my feelings, and I'm able to relieve that. But it doesn't mean that it goes away in one event. It takes time to adjust, to learn how to trust. It takes time for me to rebuild the confidence and the strength. Just as when a woman births a baby, it takes time for that woman's body to come back to a level of full functioning because of the trauma of the event that she goes through in birthing a child. So it's the same with us. When we are wounded in spirit, in soul, in body, then it requires a tremendous amount of patience. And that's one of the illusions of our compulsiveness, our compulsive behaviors, is that we tend to be, in America especially, an instant fix society. Well, what's the solution? How do I solve this relationship? It's one of the sadnesses about marriage and relationships is a lot of people either say, well, I either want it to work, and we tend to have a real black and white perspective on things. It's either going to make it or we're going to break it. And we tend to, when you minimize yourself and you become so obsessed with that kind of perspective, you lose so much and so many alternatives, so many ways of looking at things. People suffer for years in relationships because they're terrified and afraid of, if I let go, where will I be? I'll never find somebody else. You know, I'll never be loved again. This is the only opportunity. So there's a tendency to want to hang on in spite of all of the suffering and make lots of excuses. Then on the other hand, there are often people who say at the first sign of pain and suffering and turmoil and conflict, out the door. You know, I don't want to deal with this. Neither one of those are solutions. Both of them are extreme alternatives that ultimately lead to abandonment, loneliness, rejection, isolation, inadequacy, and unfulfillment. The core of it is patience for myself, sense of honesty, openness, the willingness, the need for community and support. And that's part of why I wanted to put a lot of this process in terms of grief into this weekend, because this is really essential. And I want to encourage people to continue on in terms of meditating throughout the day, to take a look at yourself, because tonight, Vespers, and our evening session is going to be a focus on reconciliation, beginning to experience a means and a way to let go. And we're going to have a few processes to share with one another, both scripturally and experientially, to see reconciliation not just as a spiritual ritual, but see it as a viable part of a daily living process that we can involve ourselves in. Things that we can take away from here and go home and do for ourselves in our own place. So, there are other things, any comments, other things that people discovered about themselves in reflecting or writing? Other feelings? Other awarenesses about behaviors?
A really painful process to go through this. I came up with many things. I really came to a point where I don't like the way I'm acting. And part of it is that I'm much more short-tempered than I used to be. I teach first graders and I have a five-year-old daughter. And when I lose my temper, it just pains me because you can see it in their eyes. You know, inappropriate. And the other thing is, I find that as I deal with something you mentioned earlier, which is all the obligations that need to be taken care of in terms of a full-time job and house that I don't know how to take care of, a yard and a car and a daughter, and myself. Comes in last. That I end up being kind of a cold, harsh drill sergeant. And it's push, 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 this needs to be done, this needs to be done. I don't. It doesn't matter if I'm sick or tired or whatever, I keep pushing. And that means that I'm pushing other people in some way. And so I went through the feelings, too, that came with that and with sobriety. There's some things that I'm scared about, some things that I'm mad at. Some things I'm mad at me. I kind of have gotten myself into a cycle. I've tried to deal with coping things in terms of physical activity or I even take my class outside and we do some things where we're yelling and it's for me. So for them, because I can see myself getting uptight and I don't want to get back into that routine of getting upset with somebody else. So I don't know where I was going with that, but I see the sad and the mad and the scared. I guess what I was saying with the cycle was that when I find myself getting uptight, then I'm mad at myself for not dealing better with it. So then there's a real cycle. Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of criticalness and impatience with, if I'm feeling the feelings, I don't like the way that I'm feeling the feelings, so I'm mad at myself for being out of control or not being the way I think I should be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, and I guess as a teacher, one of my strengths has always been being extremely patient. It's real hard in me to see that, and I wonder if I should be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it touches a lot of scare inside. What?
No, I was just relating to what Betty said about the coldness and the harshness. And that was one of the things I didn't cover last night. It was a very good one as far as I feel myself doing that, but I feel it's kind of would fall into the scare category. And that cold and harshness is part of putting myself in isolation. Mm-hmm. And if I see a problem coming up, I'll avoid it. I won't talk about it. I'll just go do something else. I'll totally avoid the issue. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with the abandonment and everything of a divorce. I have a problem now with my ex now coming around to see my sons and wanting visitation with them. And I have to bite my tongue. And my boys want my involvement with this, and I can't handle it. I tell them that they have to handle that on their own, because I have to stay out of it, because it's very upsetting to me. That's where anger and sadness, I guess, would fall into that.
Thanks for sharing that. What's in your hearts? There's a lot of silence, real heavy silence here in the room.
I can relate to what you said about self-fulfilling prophecy. Sometimes I see I have a fear of a rejection again, and sometimes I actually create in some way. I end up creating the very thing that I'm afraid of. That causes insecurities and puts a lot of pressure on people becoming intimate with it. So it's sort of a strange cycle that we come aware of sometimes. Where my insecurities and things almost cause the person to the thing that I'm afraid of ends up happening sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Do It also could happen in terms of cycles of behavior. We talk about, there's a phenomenon in grief called gifts of the universe. And gifts of the universe means that I get involved in a certain situation, but I tend to get stuck in my denial and agitation around those circumstances, and so without recognizing it, when I move on to different situations, I tend to find myself recycling the same phenomenon. Whether it's picking the same type of people in relationships that I get into, where it's starting into intimacy but running into the same level of conflict where I get to a point of agitation or out of controlness and I can't handle myself or my anger or my fear, or I feel discounted or put down. And that it is a very, you know, we understand, like in the field of domestic violence, sexual abuse and alcoholism, chemical dependency, codependency, sexual dependency, eating disorders, that when there's a phenomenon like that existing in the family, it tends to pass down generationally. That people pick up these coping and survival mechanisms. And a part that I want you to hear in all of that is that if sadness is the predominant emotion inside of myself, then in spite of how logical I think I may be as a person, it is sadness that dictates most of my behavior. If scare and fear is the emotion that tends to dominate my life, my sense of inadequacy, a fear of abandonment and rejection, then in spite of how intellectual or intelligent or righteous or, you know, ethical I think I might be, it is my fear and my scare which dictates the choices that I make in my life. If anger is a predominant emotion in my being and I'm not able to process that, then in spite of my intelligence and skill, it is anger that will dictate the choices and the behaviors that I choose. And that's a part of hearing. I want to be able to, you know, I mean, if I have one goal in this part of the process is to give you that kind of awareness to recognize that the power is within you. And it's not a power to create or to out-articulate or to understand or to figure out an answer. The issue is humility. The basis of it is the capacity for self-revelation to get to the core of who I am and how I feel. I have to be in my death to experience my resurrection. And the death of my power and my spirit and my capacity is in my grief. It's in my scares. It's in my anger. It's in my sadness. And I can only transform them to joy and gladness and excitement and empowerment when I walk through those. We tend to be real preoccupied in this culture with kind of accomplishment or status. How long did I hang in there? Who's right, who's wrong? We tend to think around divorce or separation or widowhood situations about, am I doing the right things? Especially parenting is another great big issue, is about what's the right way to parent? Am I being a good mother? Am I being a good father? If chaos or crises happens, is it my fault? Is it their fault? Am I inadequate? And we tend to be very righteous and judgmental, and that's a part of our terror and our fear. It causes a tremendous amount of isolation, rather than the capacity to acknowledge on a more fundamental level of our being, am I scared? When I can acknowledge to myself, I'm scared, because I don't have the knowledge or the wisdom, I'm immobilized, then I am more open to the resources that might be available to me. Then I might be open to go out and get parenting skills, or to go to a grief group, or to come to a weekend like this, because when I can feel the feeling, then I open myself up. But if I am so preoccupied in one of the, the two major immobilizing processes that people do to themselves is one, worry. Worry is wasted energy. preoccupation with a concern about what's right, what's wrong, lots of shoulds, lots of expectations. It's a way of defeating and immobilizing myself. And the second is guilt. Heaping upon myself, you know, just pounds and pounds and pounds of guilt. Guilt ultimately transforms to shame. The difference between guilt and shame is that guilt has to do with behaviors, shame has to do with the core of my being. That I feel the shame of who I am as a person. And that's a lot of self-righteousness and self-condemnation and self-abuse. So we worried about what does it mean to be a divorced person? What's the reflection upon me as a person who is a parent and who has a responsibility in the community, but my kid's acting up? The years that I worked with adolescents, I remember I would have them in a dorm on a college campus, and there were several young girls that would come up, and they were pregnant, 14, 15 years old. And I asked them how they were feeling, and I said they were really scared. And I said, well, are you scared of being pregnant? She says, no, I mean, you know, they'd say, no, I'm not scared of that. I'm scared of what my parents are going to do when they find out. That more than the reality of pregnancy, they're more terrified of the, you know, the experience of what's going to happen when my parents find out. So we get really enmeshed and caught up with that level of being, that level of self-indictment. Any other comments or questions? I'm going to shift directions here for a moment and talk about kids. Is this making sense to you? Are you kind of getting at the core of this? The part of starting this kind of essential process here is that until I can get to know and believe and live this for myself, see, only then will I be able to transform the way that I look at my children in terms of parenting. Because it's being in the core of my humanity that I can learn to be receptive and responsive to the humanity of children. See them as beings. See them as people in their own fear, sad, mad, anger, glad, and recognize the need to identify with them on that level. Because the greatest sadness that I experience in terms of parent-child relationships is the getting locked into roles. A parent means that I have this obligation and responsibility, and certainly there are responsibilities as a parent. But we tend to forget that we're people. And that on a very basic human level, that's where our primary interaction is together. But if we function on a basis of, I am parent, therefore I am this, and this is the way that I react to you, and you are a kid, which means you are responsible for living by the rules, doing your chores, getting good grades in school, you know, not getting in trouble in the community, so I'm not embarrassed and humiliated. See, and if we make the basis of our relationship standards of expectation, then what we literally do is discount our humanity. Children are people first. Children suffer and grieve and play and become enraged. And that's a lot of their humanity. As parents, our responsibility is to be able to provide some healthy structure and guidelines so they can begin to experience the nurturing and the affirmation. And let me kind of take you through a little bit of the child development process. There are four primary stages of child development. The first is that a child needs to know that the world is worthy of trust. The child needs to know and experience that the world is worthy of trust and I am worthwhile. The way the child experiences this, because a child comes into the world completely and totally dependent, becomes by the embodiment or the bodily experience of consistency, nurturing, affirmation, in other words, the little baby knows whether it is loved or not by the kind of response. And a child doesn't know intellectually, a child knows bodily whether a mother wants it or not, whether a mother is willing to be there, whether a father is bonded physically. And a child simply feels on a very fundamental physical level, it's either comfortable or it's uncomfortable. I'm either welcomed and accepted, or I feel pushed away, ignored, neglected, or abused, or hurt. And a child feels that physically. Those are words that we use as adults to describe, but a child simply knows that by the physical energy inside. And we understand from child psychology that children need repetition. Part of the consistency is that they need to know that, you know, that it's unconditional love means is that no matter what goes on, that I know that they are there for me. And a child then develops a deep sense of security and trust, feels valued and worthwhile and meaningful. If there is not that kind of structure and environment, then the child grows up on a gut level. Child grows up believing that either they are untrustworthy, that there is something inadequate or insufficient within themselves, or that the world itself is not worthy of trust. So on a very gut level, and this is pre-verbal, see, it isn't something that they intellectually decide, it's something that they physically experience. So the child begins to develop a sense of resistance, isolation, begins to form that self-protection at the very earliest stages. The second stage of development is separation. You know, we call that the terrible twos. The part where the child begins to differentiate and begin to experience a sense of empowerment. So we hear them saying a lot of no, a lot of defiance. It's kind of like, I want to do my thing. I want to be separate from you. What a child needs in that is a parent. What a child needs in that stage is a parent that is able to stand outside and recognize that, so that the parent does not react to those no's. That the parent instead is able to establish a sense of boundaries. And boundaries are, you have a right to your feelings and emotions. See, if you find parents who are inadequate with that, then the parents have a difficult time with the child starting the process of rebellion and separation. And oftentimes it's at this stage of life that parents can't deal with that. They get real defiant and they squash that child's rebelliousness, they squash that child's movement toward identity, toward a sense of separation. So the child feels guilty, inadequate, ashamed, wrong, and that their initiative and their ingenuity gets literally squashed. If a parent is able to be outside of that and simply say, here are boundaries in terms of what's totally non-negotiable, but with inside those things you can respond however you need to respond. What you tend to experience a lot at this point is children going into tantrums, real defiant, you know, I hate you, You know, you tell them that they can't do stuff and they shut their eyes to try to shut you out of their world as a way of, you know, pretending that you don't exist. You tell them to do something, you got to tell them 3, 4, 5 times before they're going to respond. You know, it's kind of testing the limits, and they want to find out what the boundaries are and how far you are. But what it requires, again, in terms of these boundaries, is a sense of consistency. And there's a real sense of recognizing, now this is a real important dimension, because this has a lot to do with grief for kids. That we separate behavior and being. In other words, what we can begin to teach that child at this point in their life is that there are ways that I will react to behaviors, and certain behaviors are acceptable, but I will always unconditionally love, affirm, and nurture you. One of the ways that we tend to destroy a child's self-esteem in this part is that when a child acts out in a certain behavior, instead of reacting to the behavior, we react to the child. So instead of being able to say things like, it makes me very angry when you drop glasses and break them. Okay? Instead of saying, you stupid, irresponsible little brat. See, because when we attack the child at a level of being, when we say, you know, you're stupid, you're irresponsible, you're ignorant, and when we say, you this, and we project that into the person without identifying the behavior, see, what happens is, it's just like saying that to you. If somebody said to you, I hate you, see, you find yourself in a position of helplessness. Because when somebody has a feeling about my being, I am immobilized. There's nothing I can do. I can't change my being. You know, somebody was able to say, I hate it every time I try to talk to you and you turn around and walk away from me. Okay. A behavior I can change. There's hopefulness and there's power in my ability to look at a behavior and say, oh, okay, so when I turn around and walk away, you get really mad. So if I don't want you to be mad, I think I need to stay and at least let you finish what you're going to say. See, there's hopefulness in that. But if it's just like, you are the rudest son of a gun that I've ever experienced. Okay? That kind of condemnation and judgment attacks me at the core of my being and I'm immobilized. One, because I don't know specifically what it is that I want you to change or that I can do to reconcile or to forgive. See, and this is the core issue, is that in the early stages of that development, that we need to learn the art of separation. Now, when I share these things with you, I want you to hear that all of these childhood stages apply to us as adults as well. And if we don't know, see, if we're still stuck in this level, you can't go through any of these stages until you've resolved the first. So if we're still dealing with self-trust issues, we're still literally dealing with early childhood issues of our being. And you can see from that point of view that if I get into a position of parenting and I still haven't resolved some of these things for myself, it's going to be really awkward for me to deal with another human being going through those same stages when I haven't even been able to deal with them myself. See, and that's one of the core issues in understanding the reality of parenting.
Vince, can I ask you, also saying that unless you're whole as a human, you're never going to be able to parent, stuff like that.
No, I'm not saying whole as a human.
Okay, well, how healthy do you have to be before you're going to
you're getting ahead of me.
Does anybody ever get all those worked out? I mean, are you supposed to wait till they tell you?
No.
Can I get a bar?
Yeah.
Too far away, Bar.
I think sometimes we don't recognize that things are unfinished until we bump into them in our own children. And that can raise our awareness and say, hey, I have a problem with that too. I see that you've got a problem, but to recognize I have a problem with that. That's why I'm struggling.
Yeah, ultimately where I'm going to with this is that if we can be human with our children, that we develop a deeper sense of bonding when we acknowledge our boundaries and our limits. Children accept very readily that we can make mistakes. It's when we pretend that we don't make mistakes, or we're the authority, or we're the God, that we create the separation and distance, and our relationship becomes one of real competition and intensity and mistrust and rage and anger. You know, when we can acknowledge those things, children are unconditionally forgiving if we give them the opportunity, which means we have to acknowledge our humanity. Now, I'm going to talk about the difference of roles and responsibility in family and parenting. But a part of it is saying that we have to recognize our humanness in parenting, that there's no such thing as a perfect parent. And that's one of our great failings, is because many times our assumption is, if I do everything right, my kid will never screw up. And the reality is if I'm a normal, healthy parent, your kid's going to screw up all over the place, because that's part of their humanity. And we don't want to take that birthright from them. That's a part of the process of becoming. But then the fear is, if they start screwing up, and the way that we interfere is that if in our worry and our preoccupation that when they screw up, we get enmeshed in it. So it's not just their issue and their consequences and their problem, but now it becomes our issue and our consequences and our problem. And that's one of the most difficult things that I've experienced in parenting, is that it's not just the kid and what's going on in their life, but the parents feel responsible. In all the years that I've done parenting groups for like chemically dependent parents, especially with adolescents, when kids get chemically dependent, you know, it's like the kid's been making these choices all along, and the parent comes in and is just overwhelmed with all this guilt and remorse. What did I do? And we keep trying to say to the parent, you didn't do anything, unless you held the kid down and poured liquor down their throat. You know, then you might feel some adequate, realistic guilt. But if kids experiment and use, they make the choice. You don't make the choice. If they become chemically addicted, it's because of their own physiological progression. It's not something that a parent does. A parent can be in denial and not know how to support those kind of things, but that's a parent responsibility. They can do things for themselves to be clear how to deal with this phenomenon, but they are not responsible for that kid's choices.
Yeah, but if the parent didn't communicate to the child that sense of trust, and, you know, the affirmation of those kinds of feelings as a child, would that be something that would, for example,
well, see, that's part of what we're getting to. It's the reality of understanding if there is healthy communication, trust, and bonding in a family, then you tend to find that there is less likelihood that children will choose or do things that might be self-destructive. They may still get out there and experiment, but if there's openness, the ability to communicate, a sense of trust, that oftentimes the bond and the trust in family becomes more powerful than a lot of the external curiosities. But even then, there is no guarantee. The reality is that kids will experiment, that they may get caught up in stuff, that sometimes out of their curiosity, or sometimes they just happen to be tagging along and finding themselves, because I remember one time at age 17, the first time I went out and drank, I spent 3 days in jail. And I'd been a total non-drinker to that. But the one time I go out and drink with my buddies, we go running down the freeway chased by cops, and I spend the weekend in jail. I wasn't a bad kid, necessarily. But I made the choice to get out and do that kind of stuff. You know, my mother screamed at me for days about that, because it was like, how could you do this to me, you know, blah, 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 blah. It wasn't so much that I was doing anything to her as I was in a situation, and just being a kid, on the one hand, I knew there was a part of me that says I shouldn't be doing this, that it really isn't healthy for her, and the other part of me was, well, I've never done this, and this is kind of curious, and I want to go through it. And then while we're riding down the freeway at 110 miles an hour, and cops chasing us, you know, I'm on the back seat on the floor ready to pee my pants. You know, and I'm terrified and scared to death. Of course, when my parents show up at the jailhouse, I'm standing there like big macho, you know. I mean, I'm going through all of these different emotional things, but the reality is they were my choices and my behaviors, and there's nothing my parents could have done to stop. Absolutely nothing. And that's a lot of it, is that we need to be able to recognize and how to separate behaviors from person and individual. And I'm going to get more to what Barbara's talking about in terms when we get into the second half of this about parenting, healthy parenting skills. This is all kind of a part of the setup to it. The third level is called initiation and mastery. Initiation and mastery has a lot to do with competency, confidence, individuality. Begin to explore what are my unique gifts and interests and excitement. And again, the key in all of this is that parents need to be encouraging. You know, in order for this stage to progress, I need to have a lot of encouragement, some security, so that means like consistency, boundaries, and what you tend to find, like in many unhealthy homes, what happens is parents get real caught up in roles of the way they want kids to be, so a lot of the rigid sexual stereotyping. For example, young girls often develop a lot faster than boys, so they become more athletic, they run faster, they like climbing trees, they like doing all that stuff, but if you're in a household that says, no, well, you're supposed to be in the kitchen learning to cook, and little girls don't do those things, and stop beating up your big brother, and you know, and that we tend to put a lot of negative criticism, a lot of anger, and a lot of times what's happening here is the parent's inadequacy to simply allow the child to develop their own unique personality. And what tends to get real enmeshed and confused is that parents have one agenda, the kid has their own agenda, and oftentimes if the kid doesn't live up to the parent's agenda, the kid starts feeling a lot of negative feedback. Not encouragement, but a discouragement. Not uniqueness. Oftentimes uniqueness is really discouraged and hampered in a family system. Because a child does something, the parents often say, well, what's wrong with my child? What you often also will experience in this kind of time is the child's world is beginning to expand, so they want to get out and explore and do more things. And it's the question of whether the parents respond in fear or whether they respond in trust. And a parent who's always saying, I don't want you to go out here, or I don't want you to go down that block, it's too scary, you might get picked up, you know, there are a lot of strangers that can pick you up on the street. And if there's no trust in the child, and the child is perpetually bombarded with fear about what could happen and what might happen, then what happens, the child internalizes that fear, feels a sense of inadequacy, and tends to respond to the world with fear rather than respond to the world with curiosity, trust, with a sense of boundaries. So that we can encourage the child to know how to work things. See, the things may happen, for example, in learning how to cook, learning how to sew, learning how to begin to do manual dexterity in terms of art. One of the big things we see in early childhood stuff, for example, is parents over-concerned about kids learning to color within the lines. But it may be really a benefit of a kid with a wild creative imagination that they like to color all over the place, that they have the real freedom just to, you know, and that rather than drawing pictures of a house, their concept of house looks kind of, you know, existential. You know, and we need to learn to validate that kind of initiation and mastery. You know, we have a budding artist in our hands, and yet, but again, part of our own turmoil and fear and expectations is we tend to squash this kind of stuff. Four is the level of autonomy. Autonomy means simply that the person literally kind of goes further through the art of separation, begins to get out into the world on their own. Childhood development-wise, it's their world is expanding, and now it's not their parents who are their primary influence, but they have teachers and peers and friends. They start recognizing that they have different kinds of values. They often become very rebellious. Different kinds of interest, want to spend more time away from home and family. And again, what you need is parents who recognize that the parent's responsibility right from the very beginning is the process of letting go. As the child evolves and develops in different stages of their being, it's the parent's responsibility to take away more of their restriction and authority and allow the child more responsibility over their own behavior. Oftentimes, in parenting is very, very arduous and difficult, especially when you get into the teen years, because the parent at that point is the enemy. And it takes a very strong, healthy person as a parent. Oftentimes I say to parent, the best thing you can do between ages 13 and 15 is survive. You know, if you can get to 15, sometimes there's kind of an energy shift and suddenly they settle down a little bit. But often between 13 and 15 is parents are the bad guys, you know. And you know, the adult world sucks and all your values suck and all of the stuff that you want us to do. I mean, you're just, you know, you're the over 30 old fogey. You know, every parent looks like a middle-aged person, you know.
It just brings up, I've had an incredible experience this year of letting go and letting my daughter have responsibility in a major area of her life, and that is, she's 10, will be 11 at the end of this year, and she came down with diabetes at the beginning of the year. So she's now, a big change in her life is to become an insulin-dependent diabetic, which means taking insulin twice a day, watching what she eats, monitoring her blood sugar levels, having a real elaborate set of circumstances to live with. So for several months we did that very closely together. Fortunately, I wasn't working. And after a week in the hospital, we worked a lot on meal planning and foods and just changes for her well-being. But when I went to work in the summer, that was completely given to her. Because I wasn't there to say, did you measure your insulin properly? Did you mix the dosages right? Did you take the right amount? And she has complete control over taking insulin for herself. Eating or choosing not to eat, which can put her into a real scary situation. And it's really amazing for me to realize that, in fact, she has mastered this extremely well. And my greatest fears of her going into a diabetic coma, off at school because she doesn't want to eat a snack in front of the middle school kids. She hasn't done it. So for 9 months, she has assumed complete control over a part of her life that I really had to let go. And pretty incredible what kids can do.
That's right. A tremendous gift.
I was real impressed. The other day you used a verse from the Gospel of John that has always meant a lot to me, where John the Baptist points to Jesus and says, he must increase, I must decrease. There's a Grunewald painting of that, but to use that of parenting the way you did, that was really interesting, that parents have to say that of their kids, they must increase, I must decrease, right. Sort of in that letting go
process. See, but it takes a confident person of self-esteem to know how to decrease and to let go. And that's the difficult task, because we feel an awesome responsibility. And a lot of the assumption is we tend to do a lot of things in our culture around having babies. I mean, we go through all the prenatal classes and, natural childbirth classes, and, we get all prepared to have this brand new little bundle come into the world. But then part of the dysfunction of our culture is the illusion of, well, I'm a parent, and I've got this kid for all these years. So the assumption is, well, you've been a parent for 10 years, you should know how to parent a 10-year-old, See, but a 10-year-old is totally different from a newborn. And it takes a whole different set of skills. And they're going through all kinds of transformations in terms of their own stages of developing. And then having a 13-year-old is a brand new ballpark. You know, because we're dealing completely with a whole new being. You know, I mean, you know, this is, you know, just hormones personified. You know, they're just off the wall, all over the place. And each stage demands a different level of expertise. And that's a part of what happens is that as they go through those stages, we go through the same stages with them. And learning to parent a teenager is a brand new phenomenon for parents, regardless of if I've had them in my life for 12 or, you know, hopefully you've got some stability and history and tradition and some trust built up. But part of what I want you to do is, in exposing this, is to begin to now look at the phenomenon like, phenomenon like separation and divorce. Whenever there is a catastrophic event or a major terminating or changing event in our lives, there is a major transformation which literally will throw the child back into these same questions of realities. Because remember, here we're talking about consistency, we're talking about nurturing and encouragement, and we're talking about boundaries. And what these kind of phenomena do is suddenly throw all of that back up into the air. So children grieve the same way. And children go back into their own fundamental levels of grief and insecurity and fear. And so a part of what we're talking about is the need for redefining boundaries. Now, part of the first stage of that is permission to grieve. That one of the first levels of acceptance is the ability to know that it's not just me who experiences a divorce or a loss or a change. Children experience that too. They may have two people they love who choose not to live together. And so now they have long distance parents. Or one parent who abandons them, that their concept of divorce is simply to get out and to get away altogether. So they have a lot of loss and abandonment issues. And if the parents separate, there's not the money there used to be, and the one parent who is with them oftentimes has to go out and get a job and work for themselves. So the kids are exposed to neighbors, babysitting, latchkey kids, having to go to daycare. You know, there's a whole variety of non-availability through time, major transformation. And what often happens is the adjustment and the guilt. And see, and this is part of the awkward transition, because the parent, the person who experiences the divorce or separation, is certainly going through their own loss and grief. And they're up and down in terms of all of this, because they've got to redefine it for themselves. But the child is going through the exact same thing. The exact same thing. And it doesn't have to be just separation and divorce. It can be a major crisis in the family, explosive events that happen in a family, a major job change, moving to a new area, going to a new school, the immobilization or the disability of one parent, where there may have been a parent who was often working a lot and suddenly that parent is home. So all of the rituals and daily living patterns that we tend to get into, suddenly those daily living patterns don't exist anymore. And all of that is a part of loss and grief. And the children go through those same stages. The same stages we described before happen with the children. They get real agitated. They get in shock. They're in denial. They start acting out. They get depressed or suicidal. They don't know where to go with themselves. And that's a part of it, is that loss and grief for children is And I think part of the illusion is people say, well, I'm responsible to deal with my children's loss and grief, but I'm such a mess, you know, how can I deal? And part of what I want you to hear with that is that it's okay for everybody to be in loss and grief, that you don't have to be resolved with your own before you can deal with somebody else's. The point is that where the bonding and consistency can be is that we acknowledge on a very human level that we're in a very awkward stage of transition together. For the parent to acknowledge and identify that I'm terrified or scared or I'm real mad right now, but my mad is not at you. My mad is at the situation and at the behaviors. So we need to reaffirm our love, reaffirm our care and concern, but also make the child aware that I require energy to take care of myself. See, what we're literally doing is, one, reaffirming the level of trust in the child. Two, we're helping the art of separation, that if I seem agitated or angry, the better I get at identifying my agitation and anger, then I can help the child separate it, that when you see me angry or sad or in tears, or if I just break down or I don't have the energy to go out and do stuff, it's not because I don't care about you. Because that's one of the things that children tend to do. Children tend to assume a sense of responsibility. If my parents are unhappy and split up, it's because, you know, because they couldn't handle me. If I wasn't such a bad kid, if I didn't act out, if I wasn't throwing temper tantrums, then maybe they wouldn't have gotten a divorce. And children always see, because in a children's perspective, a child doesn't understand the phenomenon of marriage or relationship or grief and those kind of things. A child tends to be very egocentric, meaning that they think they are at the center of the universe and the world revolves around them, you know. And so the assumption is when something's getting crazy out here in the world, there's something that they're responsible for, that they've created the craziness. And they don't learn the art of that because they're not mature enough yet. They don't have the intellectual perspective to see that. And that's how parents can help them to recognize, by teaching them the art of separation. This is happening to me, and this is between, you know, your father and I. This has nothing to do with you as a person.
Can I raise a question while I'm thinking
about
it?
Sure.
My oldest daughter just recently sometimes will come up and say, Mom, you know, it really hurts me to see you so sad. What can I do to cheer you up? And I want to say to her, maybe I have said to her, well, maybe I just need to be sad. Don't worry about it. But she wants to cheer me up and make things better. I don't quite know how to respond to what's happening for her.
And a part of that kind of thing is just the capacity to acknowledge what she's done, and that it makes me feel warm inside that you care about my sadness. And I appreciate your willingness to be there with me. I'm going to feel my sadness because it's my sadness. But I want you to know how much I care about you, that you have the sensitivity to care about me and my sadness. So I can affirm her for her concern and still own my sadness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
See, and that's a part of it. When I learn the art of separation, I can give kids permission to go through their grief. You know, because I'm mad at your dad, you know, doesn't mean you have to be mad at your dad. Because kids often get caught, especially in separation and divorce, with an allegiance, or even within a marriage or a family, they get caught with an allegiance. If mom's angry at dad, what side do I take? Who do I validate? And it's important to be able to help children know that they don't have to take any side, and it's not their issue. That if we're in conflict, it's our conflict, it's not your conflict. And you begin to see that the importance of getting into our grief and owning grief as our phenomenon is a way that we can become more effective in our parenting, that we don't have to be together in our grief in order to be effective in parenting. It's just that we can be clearer in setting the boundaries of what's mine and what's theirs. And when they do their grief, to give their permission to be in their grief, it's okay for you to be mad, and you can be mad at my behavior, you can be mad at my decisions, and I can still love you even if you're mad at those decisions. See, but I have to have a semblance of me and myself and what's myself and their and their grief, because I'm not responsible for their grief. And this is one of the tragedies and the ways we get stuck, that if parents can't see themselves as separate, then parents usually get very enmeshed with, you know, and feel responsible for their children's grief. You go through a separation, divorce, conflict in a family, major transition and turmoil, it's going to cause grief. There's no way that anybody can stop the grief. It's a normal human phenomenon. But all too often, this is part of what we tend to experience, is that parents feel guilty, feel responsible, try to go out of their way, they try to bargain away the kids' grief. And so what happens is the kids feeling like, you know, there's something wrong with me because I'm feeling these feelings. And eventually what happens is the family gets so enmeshed that when one person starts to feel grief, everybody else feels the same grief. That's what we call codependency. In the dysfunctional family, that the family is so enmeshed that when one person starts to feel some intensity of feelings, that everybody else starts to adapt to it, get preoccupied and concerned with it. We start walking on eggshells around each other. One person's feeling sad and somebody else starts compensating. Often kids, if there's a separation, the kids start to try to act like little adults. It's like daddy's not home or mommy's not home, so I should fill in that role. So I become super responsible, or I try to be a caretaker. Kids try to assume and take on roles. And what's really going on is they're scared to death. They're scared of abandonment. They're really sad. Sometimes they may feel mad inside, but they feel guilty for feeling mad, so they compensate for being mad by being responsible. Sometimes it's just the opposite. The kids get so mad, they just get agitated and start acting out all over the place. They do all kinds of bizarre things. And it's kind of recognizing that for a young person, it's a part of their unsophisticated ways. As adults, you know, when we get into our coping mechanisms, we get pretty sophisticated. We have lots of rationalizations and ways that we can turn good behaviors into frozen grief and justify what we're doing. Oftentimes what happens with young people is that they're not as sophisticated. They haven't learned how to manipulate the system as well yet. So usually when their stuff comes out, it comes out in pretty bizarre ways. They tend to be really irrational or out of control or agitating. They tend to get real dramatic in the ways that they react and respond. And that's just because they're not sophisticated at it. The feelings are there, but they don't know how to cover the feelings as well as we do. And that's where parents tend to get real caught up in, especially in adolescence, all of the acting out behaviors we tend to see in adolescence. Whether it's going out and joining a punk rock crowd, you know, and wearing all these bizarre clothes, or getting into these death cults or devil worship types of things, or it's the music, or they end up destroying a lot of their clothes, destroying their things, running away, spending lots of time out, and go down to the bowling alley and play video machines, you know, 24 hours a day, sit in their room, blare their music at 10 megawatts or whatever, that they tend to do lots of kind of a real projective type of things, and that's real normal for them because they haven't learned the sophistication. In many ways, adult grief is a lot more difficult to deal with because it's much more subtle. We're more sophisticated. We had lots of years to fine-tune our cons. Kids tend to be less sophisticated, so their cons come out, but they're pretty bizarre. You know, they're kind of all over the place. But again, the key issue in all of this is until we learn how to react and respond, our grief, their grief, and they have a right to their grief. Now the second part is when you have permission to grieve, the second thing is to know your boundaries or limits. And what that means is there may be certain things that we can deal with in terms of family meetings or communicating or trying to stay healthy and clear. But if we're overwhelmed with our own grief and we see our kids acting out and we're feeling, you know, too sensitive to that, where we can't handle it, then part of knowing our own boundaries and limits is sometimes being able to say, I know you need support, but I can't handle it right now. And so it's being willing to acknowledge those limits and go out and find support system. Let your kids go to counseling. Let your kids talk to somebody else. If you have friends or other people in the community who can do that, encourage them to get support. One of the things that we tend to find, for example, is that children of divorce and single parent families have a way of going out and finding surrogate parents. You know, they like to find the neighbors or people that they feel accepted by and call them mom and dad too. Some of their best friends, you know, they go over there and they like to have, and the more surrogate parents they have, the happier they usually are. But a part of it is being clear that it's okay for them to have that kind of support depending on the kind of people they gravitate to. You can still have some say about that. Or the need to maybe go to therapy if necessary, you know, giving a child permission to do that kind of thing, although most children are real reticent to go to that kind of, I mean, that tends to be on one extreme. The idea is the ability of I don't have to resolve all of my child's grief, and the acknowledgement that as a human being, I don't have the capacity to resolve all of my child's grief, especially if I'm frozen in my own, learning to acknowledge and understand, you know, is really essential. Thirdly, in terms of redefining boundaries, is that as we acknowledge and give permission to grieve and go through setting our limits and boundaries and learning to readapt to that life, it's the building of new traditions. And the building of new traditions is literally going back here to stage one and starting to work through the process again, to redefine myself, to redefine our family, because the family unit has changed. We can't hang on to mom and dad and kid. We can still maybe hang on to mom loves you and dad loves you, but they live 200 miles apart. And so there are limits, and we have to be real clear about those limits. And, you know, one of the most awkward and difficult things in this kind of process is, for example, holidays, visitation rites, whatever word the traditions often get thrown up in the air, and that you find that people are split because, you know, those times around birthdays, holidays, anniversaries, Christmas, Easter, summer vacation, it becomes a real awkward transition, and there's tremendous amount of grief that goes on in simply redefining those kind of boundaries. And a part of it is being able to, again, allow for the dialogue, allow for the grief process, setting some different kinds of limits about what's expected and what can happen. And I'm going to talk more about that in the second half, but I just want you to see that in terms of a grief process. That's really important. The grief process goes on more in terms of just the loss of something. There's as much grief in the redefining of something. Where do we go from here? How do we build something new? What is my relationship now? Because eventually what you'll often deal with then is that in the phenomenon of blended families or dating, the kids are going to have a lot of grief when it comes around to mom and dad getting interested in somebody else. So now we got a stranger coming into the house, and the kids often have a lot of conflict around, I'm not going to call them dad. That's not my dad. This is my dad. So, but what is the role of this other person that suddenly comes in the house? And often there's a lot of jealousy and grief that goes on because if mom and dad are dating again, that means there's more time away from the kids. And the kids often get very, very protective and have a lot of reactiveness to having another adult consume. I've only got one parent that I'm primarily with, and if now that person is consuming some time. So there are lots of decisions to be made and lots of ways that it's important to understand that as we emerge in new relationships or changing relationships, that the kids are going to go through a lot of transformation. Well, see, this is one of the things about what I talked about last night about the nuclear family. That if the illusion is mom and dad and the kids, then you're absolutely right. That the kid would experience a real sense of rejection and alienation. That's why to experience child rearing in the context of community or neighborhood where there are more support systems so that the child's security can be an expanded security. For example, our 14-year-old that we have at home, our 14-year-old has three other women, you know, mothers of her friends that she loves to go over, and she just pours her guts out. You know, they all call us and tell us what's going on with that kind of stuff. But it's kind of like that, you know, she doesn't want to talk with her mom, and she doesn't want to talk with me because she thinks I'm disgusting, you know. You know, you always lecture me, and I always tell her, hey, people pay hundreds of dollars to hear me lecture, you know? And you get it for free. You know? You know? But it's like, you know, there are points and times in their own lives where it's important for them to go out and experience other adults, and it takes parents who have the confidence to be able to let them go do that. So that they can develop that kind of rapport and relationship. And what it does, see, young people are very, very resilient. And that one of the most difficult things for them to do is that divorce or separation or conflict in a family often leaves them extremely limited. For them to know that there are resources beyond just the family can be an extreme sense of relief for them. If you get that family no talk rule, where I'm in a family, there's not the energy, the parent is emotionally not available because of their own grief, and I have nowhere to go with mine, and oftentimes that kind of isolation is devastating. So helping to expand the reality of saying that there is hope in humankind, that, you know, that there is more to neighborhood and community, and that there are people who can be trusted.